Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Well, except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
We're coming to you from the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco, but you know, we like to imagine ourselves down in Stanford Corner, sitting underneath the veranda in Philosophy Corner there.
Today we're going to examine two things, science and religion and their relationship. Are these two ways of explaining the same thing, Ken?
Oh, well, I mean, I think science is a way of explaining things and, you know, potentially everything. I'm kind of a scientistic guy, I have to admit. And religion, well, I don't know what business it's in, but I don't think it has much explanatory work to do, John.
So you're just one of these young guys that thinks that science is going to explain everything, and that'll be that.
Well, I'm not so young anymore. What I am is a post-Darwinian, I think, and a thoroughly modern guy. I mean, there was a time when you could have believed that, like the design argument for the existence of God was a good explanation of why there are people and animals with all these complexes. Well, but I don't think anybody post-Darwinian can believe that anymore.
Let's stop a minute and talk about what the design argument is, or I should say the design arguments. There's a very old argument, and I would guess it's the argument for the existence of God that has won the most adherence to
religion.
Yeah,
I think that's probably right.
And that's the idea that if you look around the world and you see all the complexity and the way that things seem to be designed for each other, fruit trees seem to be designed for people to eat. We are incredibly more complex than the most complicated machine, and no one would ever come across a machine and say, oh, that just happened. So that argument, the classic design argument, is the one to which you refer.
Yeah, but I think Darwin explains that capacity without positing, you know, explain that complexity without positing an intelligent designer. So I just,
what do you mean positing?
You know, without supposing that
supposing,
there is.
Supposing, yeah. Why use a $5
word? Yeah, you're referring to some other design argument.
Well, there's an argument that says, okay, I'll give you that, but evolution itself, the possibility of evolution, the possibility of a universe, anything like the one we have that could support life, depends on the fine-tuning of lots of physical constants.
Yeah.
And what's the explanation for that? Why do we have a universe where the law of gravity and the nature of space-time is just suited evolution to occur?
Oh, it's luck, I think, probably. Just random chance or something like that. You know, look, I'm going to concede something. I'm not saying, when I say science can explain everything, I'm not saying that every question is a scientific question. I mean, when science ends, there's still stuff left over. And, you know, there's ethics, there's what's good and bad, how should I live my life? So science doesn't do everything there is to do.
Well, this is good, Ken. We've been at it for 2 minutes, and you're already conceded a lot. You're no longer a simple-minded scientist. scientistic person. A scientist is a person who does science. A scientistic person is a person who believes that science answers all questions. And Ken, you've heard the conversion of Ken from a scientistic person to a more well-rounded philosopher. But we're going to hear now from someone who is a scientist but believes there's a lot more in the universe than science thinks of. Listen to the piece from Amy Standen, our roving philosophical reporter, and you'll know what I mean, Ken.
Ask anyone who's devoted his life to a single pursuit, and there's usually a story behind it. This is Bob Russells.
I was always just fascinated with science. Got a telescope when I was a kid, a Bosch and Lomb spotterscope, and saw Saturn the first night and called Dad outside and said, look, that's Saturn. And he said, oh, no, it can't be Saturn. You know, you're just beginning. I said, no, it's Saturn. Take a look. And it was Saturn. It was cool. So I was always very at home in nature. I knew the planets backwards when I was a kid. I used to tell people the names of them in reverse order, you know, because I loved space so much. And always wanted to be the first person on Mars. Dad died suddenly when I was 12, and that really sent a lot of complications into my life. After a few months, I got up the nerve to ask the Episcopal minister, or priest, really, about Dad in heaven, because the minister had been very close. I had been an acolyte and knew him very well. So Mom invited him for dinner, and afterwards I took him out to my shop and asked him, you know, will I see Dad in heaven? And he put his hand on my shoulder and said, Bob, because of science, we don't believe in heaven anymore. Really kind of a devastating thing to say. I think I realized that he was trying to be honest with me and not give me false hopes. I also realized that it couldn't be true. The God I believe in is a God of love and compassion who created me and created my dad and my mom and wouldn't abandon my dad or my relation with my dad just because the conceptual framework of heaven and earth was inadequate for it. And he posed it as if it was a conflict. Because of science, we don't believe in heaven. And I would rather have said, well, because of science, we don't have the same conception of heaven. Not that there is no possible conception of heaven, because that's just more than the power of science can give you.
Bob Russell stuck with science, eventually getting a doctorate in physics, but he always felt that there were questions science couldn't answer. Today, Russell is the director of the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences in Berkeley, where his work explores that paradox he first encountered when he was 12.
So science not only is a window on the world, but it's also a window on a world which points beyond itself. The world raises that question, well, why are we here? Why is the world here? Why does it make sense? Why is it so beautiful? Are those valid questions? And if you say, well, they aren't, then that's fine. If you say they are, they lead beyond science into this whole world of aesthetics and morality and religion. You know, is my dad just gone? And if so, well, what's the meaning of love and building a better relationship and getting an insurance policy and sending kids to college? I mean, what is the broader framework in which all that has meaning? And if there is no framework, then why do you do it? Why do science? And what I'm suggesting is that probably because it's so wonderful and exciting and challenging and fun, but it's also is a connection to, for me at least, to God, who's the source of all that is. In a sense, looking at God's handiwork. It's like standing from the Grand Canyon, you have this feeling of, wow, it's huge.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy. Ken, you know, that was a very thoughtful piece from Amy, and it makes me reflect on the rather interesting fact that historically, the things that drive people to religion, that is, the things of that take the form of a philosophical argument or an argument that could be reconstructed philosophically, tend to be of two almost diametrically opposed types. One is the one we mentioned, the classic design argument that says, look, the world is such a wonderful place. How could that have happened unless a God designed it for us? And the other one kind of says, look, the world is such a place with so many shortcomings.
Yeah.
People die young, that we're not friendship isn't over. People who do outrageous things seem to thrive. People who live moral lives seem to suffer. There must be more to it than this. There must be a heaven and a hell. So those two arguments, those two positions, seem to me the great things that drive people to religion, and yet they don't necessarily fit very comfortably together.
Well, that's true. Maybe we can talk to our guest about these matters. Our guest today is one of the world's leading relativistic cosmologists, Professor George Ellis of the University of Cape Town. His scientific work focuses on the question whether or not there was ever a start to the universe, and indeed whether there is only one universe or many. He is renowned also for his bold and innovative contributions to the dialogue between science and religion. It's for that work that he was chosen by the John Templeton Foundation to receive the 2004 Templeton Prize for Progress Toward Research or Discoveries about Spiritual Realities. The Templeton Prize, for those of you who don't know, is the largest annual monetary prize given to an individual, larger than the Nobel Prize. It's over $1 million. It will be awarded to Professor Ellis by the Duke of Edinburgh in a private ceremony at Buckingham Palace on May 5th. Professor Ellis joins us from the studios of 567 Cape Talk in Cape Town, South Africa. Professor Ellis, well, welcome to Philosophy Talk, and congratulations on being on your new status as the 2004 Templeton Prize laureate.
Many thanks, and thank you for having me on your show.
Professor Ellis, this is John Perry. I have to admit, I'm a little awestruck talking to a relativistic cosmologist. I couldn't even spell that, much less do that.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you a question first. Earlier, Ken and I discussed the kind of two different design arguments, the classical one that says, given the way the universe works, somebody must have intervened and designed the particular world we find here on Earth. The other one says, no, you have to go back even further than that. The universe is such a fragile set of constants, basic physical constants, that seem fine-tuned to allow for the emergence of life, and there must have been design behind that. Does either or both of those arguments among the things that appeal to you?
Yeah, in a sense, the old design arguments, you know, God designing giraffes and zebras and so on, that switch to God, if you take the creator God behind the universe, it switched to, in effect, God designing the laws of physics. And the thing about it is that if you look at the way the laws work, they are truly wondrous in what happens, because there are these electrons and protons interacting through the electromagnetic force, which in the end is what makes our bodies function. And they do so in such a way as to allow us to exist with self-consciousness arising out of our brains. Now, you mentioned the fine-tuning, but I want to emphasize that. As a cosmologist, one imagines universes with different laws of physics, different kinds of matter in existence, and so on. And what you can show fairly conclusively is almost any changes you make to the laws of physics and the whole system simply doesn't work. You don't get protons or neutrons, atoms don't form, or the DNA doesn't have the right angle to close up on itself. All sorts of things go wrong. And so there is an incredible fine-tuning in terms of possible universes out of which we could have been made. This one is an extraordinary special universe.
So it's an extraordinarily special universe. Lots of possible universes in which we wouldn't be here, matter That's like right. this wouldn't be here. And, they would probably last for a short time, or, lots of bizarre
never
possibilities.
Get cool enough for,
I don't know what that shows. I think it shows, one might think it shows that we're extraordinarily lucky in some ways. It's just luck, it's just blind chance that this universe is actual rather than one of those other ones.
There are two different ways of being lucky, and I think it's really important to distinguish them. One is just plain luck. There's one universe and things just happen to be this way. They could have been otherwise, and it's just this incredible chance that happened. Now, the point is, in that use of the word luck or chance, you're not saying that it's a probable universe. You're admitting it's incredibly improbable, but just out of all of those improbable universes, the one which allows us just happened to be. Okay. This must be contrasted with the multiverse, the idea that there's millions and millions of universes, or at least millions of regions like our bit that are expanding, and these are all different. They expand different rates. They've got different physical constants and so on. That's a much stronger kind of case, because in that case, your argument is, look, there's these zillions and zillions of universes, and most of them it doesn't work out, but look, there's so many of them that there's a good chance in one or two of them it'll function, and so, of course, we then are in one or two of them. So if you want to try this as an explanation, the first kind of chance admits everything is terribly improbable, and scientists don't like that. It doesn't lead anywhere. The second one, you can start to play with. You can start and try and doing statistics on this ensemble of universes and so on. And so that's the one which I would say is most popular as a purely scientific explanation.
The fact of the matter is, I may be corrected, but I'm inclined to think there's just one universe. It's the only universe we make observations in. That is, when you're talking about an ensemble of universes or possibilities, you're adopting a perspective that no human has. Our only perspective is in this universe, and we know it's fine-tuned. The probability is one. So isn't there something a little fishy about the reasoning that does statistics on a bunch of possibilities when the only observation that we have to work with is the one that gives it a probability of one that the universe is fine-tuned? I don't know if I said that correctly, but I'm sure you get the drift. Yeah.
You're talking the way which I very much like. just one point about it. This idea of multiverses was explored by science fiction writers a very long time ago. There's a book called Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon that is justly famous for its fantastic vision of a god creating universe after universe after universe, most of which are failures, but one or two of them work. The idea of the multiverse now is being proposed by quite a number of very serious scientists, including Professor Sir Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal of Great Britain, who's written a number of books about it. And the thing is, the reason he is proposing it is he does realize the fine-tuning. He's looked at this, he's looked at all of these coincidences that are needed between all the forces of nature, and so he's really struck by the fine-tuning, and that's why he proposes the multiverse. Now, my problem with this is it scientific or not? And the point is, in any scientific theory, you've got to be able to do some observations to check your hypothesis, mm-hmm. and then you come back and you say, look, it's a good hypothesis or bad. Now, the problem is, in this case, there's not a single observation you can do, because all of these other universes either are beyond our horizon. We have a horizon in the universe, and you can't see beyond it because light hasn't been able to travel since the beginning of the universe to us from greater distances. So one possibility is there's all of these bits attached to us in our own universe, but beyond testing. And so never, it's not just that, you know, there's no new telescope you can build. There's no new thing which will be created. As long as you believe in relativity, never, ever will we ever have data.
Right.
That makes it metaphysics to me, not physics.
Well, it sounds like we're in John and my realm, the realm of philosophy. We'll take this matter up some more after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest today joins us live from South Africa. He's Professor George Ellis of the University of Cape Town, the winner of this year's Templeton Prize for Progress Toward Research or Discoveries about Spiritual Realities.
Professor Ellis, I want to pick up on one thing you said. Hold on, Ken wants to get in a little bit more information.
Yeah, here. We'd like you to join our discussion, too. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment. We'll be right back.
The amazing Mahalia Jackson, and he's got the whole world in his hands, or maybe she's got the whole world in her hands. I don't know. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Templeton Prize winner George Ellis of the University of Cape Town. He's coming to us live from South Africa. We're talking about the conflict, or supposedly, between science and religion, and we'd like to hear what you have to say. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the comments button up at the right. We'll read your comment on the air if it's a good one.
Here's our question. This is our question for our listeners. Can science explain everything, or are there questions left unanswered even after science has done its all? Here's my question for you, Professor Ellis. I want to pick up on something you said about God. The philosopher David Hume has this lovely passage where he says, well, even if you accept the argument from design, how do you know that you get anything like the Christian God, the omnipotent, perfect God, that you might get some very imperfect God that botched up thousands of worlds before he hit on one even as good as this one. Now, I suspect that the spiritual realities that the Templeton Foundation is excited about, and the ones I would love to believe in, aren't adolescent gods spinning out dozens of really fouled up universes, and they're not evil demons spinning out well-designed universes in order to laugh at the poor residents of them, but something that meets more of our traditional religious needs. So granting the fine-tuning argument for the sake of argument, how do we get something out of that that's kind of religiously palatable?
What I would say here is we must look at the different kinds of data about the universe. Now, we get data from the big telescopes, the kind of thing on which we know the universe is expanding, where we measure the microwave background and all that. That's one kind of data. But we are beings living in the universe, and because we're living in it, we're made of the stuff of the universe. Our own experience is also data about the universe, and so that's a different kind of data which we also have to include. Now, traditional physical cosmology doesn't look at that, but as philosophers, this is definitely part of what one looks when one's looking at the scene as a whole. And so then, as was mentioned earlier, and what was something that you two said, two of the domains which lie right outside are ethics and aesthetics. And so the key issue here is, are those telling us anything about the universe as such, or are they kind of freakish byproducts of the immaterial forces at work and they actually don't mean anything? And so I think that's the kind of issue which I would move to next.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you, those are important issues, and I think we should talk about them. But I still want to take you back a step, because I'm still puzzled about something. Suppose that we grant the multiverse and that our universe is only one out of a multiplicity of possibilities, and and this fine-tuned thing, these fine-tuning of these cosmological constants is all that makes us possible, right? And you ask, and I suppose you want to ask the question, well, why this one? And you want some explanation for that. And the explanation is supposed to be, well, it's God had some purpose. But I think that's a non-explanation. Right, I think because you know, on the one hand, you could just have the universe and the bare fact of it, and you could say it's unexplainable. It's just the bare fact. Or you could say, well, there's God, and He has some purpose, but we have no idea how, you know, the universe relates to God's purposes. How it could even achieve God's purposes? What God's purpose could be in creating this thing? So it's no better.
So Ken, our two questions are really related. That is, if you say something's responsible for the fine tuning, how do you know what? And you should be careful not hypothesizing more than is needed to explain the fine-tuning. And, you know, ethics and all that, I guess, has to be appealed to round out the picture.
Right. But I'm also saying, Professor Ellis, that I think maybe the fine-tuning itself does not have any ultimate explanation. It's just the brute fact at the foundation of the universe. I mean, explanation stops somewhere. Why not there? Yeah.
I would accept that as one logical logical position, and if you take that position, then that is a coherent position. Scientists are always looking for unification. They want to bring more and more data within their capacity of understanding within unified theories. That's one of the huge movements in science. And so a theory that you had like that, which sort of said that about the universe, and then somewhere else there's ethics and aesthetics existing with absolutely no link, that is a weaker kind of theory with less explanatory power than one that tries to pull them together and to say there's a common thing which underlies both ethics and aesthetics and the existence of the universe. So that's a much more unified theory with much greater explanatory power.
I see the line. We have a lineup of callers. You know, let some of them in to join our conversation. Malada or Malada in Sunnyvale. Do I have got that right?
Yeah, I'm Maladi.
Maladi. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Maladi.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for Professor Ellis. This is regarding, what we're talking about, multi-universes. In fact, the concept of multi-universes has been talked about in Hindu philosophy for ages, for several hundreds of years, if not thousands. In fact, specifically, it's mentioned that there are 14 lokas, or 14 spheres of existence. And the reason why we only see the earthly reality is because our senses are tuned outward, and that's what we see. And once you turn your mind inward, that's when, you know, you get a glimpse of what's possible, you know, beyond our realms of senses. And also, as you were talking about God's purpose, it's also mentioned that in the scriptures that God's purpose, there's no such purpose other than it's the whole universe creation and dissolution, and again recreation is a mere sport which happens at the will of God.
A mere sport. That's an interesting line. Thank you, Maladi. Professor Ellis, you have any response to that?
Yeah. What comes to me out of that is the fact that supposing you have a multiverse, this still doesn't prove either that God exists or doesn't exist. It could be that God used a multiverse as the way of creating a fine-tuned universe. So having the multiverses by itself has actually got nothing to say about the existence of God or not. It's like so many cases, you simply push the problem back one stage and you still have the same questions left once you've got there.
We're talking to Professor George Ellis of the University of Cape Town in South Africa. The question for today is whether there are questions that are that science can't answer. Professor Ellis, getting back to your position, which is that we have to look at the total evidence, and aesthetics and ethics offer us some evidence that needs to be explained. Now, there's an assumption there. I'm not saying it's an unarticulated assumption or an undefended assumption, but there is an assumption there that ethics and aesthetics aren't just reducible to facts about matter in motion. Ken can explain what we mean by reducible, or you can. I'll just pass that off to someone else.
We'll give Professor Ellis that. Yeah.
I would put it the following way. Let's take ethics, because the case of aesthetics is much more difficult.
Great.
In the case of ethics. So how should we behave? What are the ultimate rules about what's good, what's bad, what should be done, what shouldn't be done? The issue, in the way I would put it, is a very simple one. Do human beings invent it, or do they find it out? Now, in the case of mathematics, one can make a claim that one finds out mathematics. The number pi, the square root of 2, are not invented by human beings. They're discovered by human beings. In fact, people didn't want to find out that the square root of 2 was irrational. It was forced on them by the nature of reality. And in a sense, the suggestion which I would make is that morality is real. There is a real difference between good and evil. It's not a social construct. It doesn't vary with societies. It goes across all societies. That we are, for instance, able to say that what happened at September the 11th in New York was evil. And it was evil irrespective of who you are, what culture you come from, and for that matter, people in Alpha Centauri or Andromeda Galaxy would recognize as evil. So that's the moral realism position. It means morality cannot be reduced to anything else. It has its own intrinsic nature in existence.
Professor Ellis, I think there are lots of questions about that, and I'll try to press them on you in a little bit, right. But I'm going to let a caller join us and see what they think. Liz Simba in Berkeley, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So what's your question or comment?
I was just wanted to comment on your question, can science prove everything? Well, I think science, like right now, I mean, like people are having problems trying like to accept things in life, and part of it, and like I think science needs to start looking less at so much the physical and start paying attention more to the like association of the metaphysical with the physical, because right now everybody's trying to find physical proof, numbers, and everything, and they just, and if they don't get it, then they don't accept it. And some things happen, and you can't, and it's hard to explain. And I think more people just need to maybe just learn to accept it. And kind of let it go.
Go with the flow. That's my religion sometimes, at least on weekends.
Yeah, thanks, Liz Simba. Professor Ellis, a question arises out of that. I mean, you said this ethics is this objective sort of mind-independent, human-independent thing. It's independent of culture or societies or whatever, or our beliefs. It's just out there. Yep. But, you know, if it is just out there, like mathematics and like the physical world, then it should be, can't it be investigated scientifically? I mean, couldn't there be a science that was not a reductionistic science?
I mean, for example, you don't have to believe that truths about numbers are reduced to truths about molecules in motion to suppose that mathematics is an objective science that should be studied by mathematicians. I guess those are scientists. They can apply to the National Science Foundation for money. I guess that's the test.
Are you two disagreeing with each other?
Well, we do that a lot. Yeah. So I wonder what you think, though. I mean, can't there be a scientific study that's not a reductionism is one thing, and scientifically accessible is another thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Let me be very clear about this. You can study ethics. You can certainly study ethics. You can try to do it in a scientific way in terms of forming hypotheses, seeing how they work, comparing with the data. But when I'm saying ethics is not, there's actually two very different things. One is understanding ethics, where it comes from, how it works. The other is actually making ethical choices. Now, the following statement I will be prepared to defend very strongly. You cannot go to a scientist and say to him, as a scientist, tell me what should be done about Iraq today.
Yeah.
What does science say you should do in Iraq? The answer is science doesn't say anything about Iraq because it's totally outside the domain of competence of science to say anything of the sort.
I agree with you about that.
The
caller, Andy in Berkeley, you would like to join our discussion? What's your comment or question?
Hi. Yeah, I guess if you pose the question in a certain way, you can say, yes, of course, science can't answer this or that question, but I don't think too many scientists would suggest that science gets you to the answer of what to do in Iraq. I think... But when it comes to scientific claims, there's a long history of organized religion making scientific claims, and it just seems to me that roughly speaking, over the last few centuries, they've been in full-scale retreat from those scientific claims to the point where we get now, where it seems like the view in vogue is, well, okay, a deity brought us all these scientific rules that we as organized religions questioned for so long. And so it just seems like they've finally gotten to the point where well, okay, we give up, and we throw our arms in the air and say, okay, well, everything you now know and have proven, despite all of the scientists in history who've been killed or imprisoned for stating their views, all of that actually comes from a deity who let you come to these conclusions and give us these rules.
I just wonder
what your commentators have to say about that.
Okay, Professor Ellis, that's a question I think directed at you.
Yeah, I agree completely. Organized religion has claimed far too much in the past. It has had to retreat, and it was a big mistake it made. That doesn't change the fact there are foundational or metaphysical issues which science is quite simply unable to answer. The scientific method is not able to answer why there are laws of physics, why there are particular laws of physics, why there's a particular universe. These are all meta-scientific questions which science can't answer by the very limits of the scientific method, and you have to go to metaphysical rather than scientific methods to investigate that. Second comment is that while I agree completely about in the past about people from the religion side being dogmatic, it's my experience that in the current climate there are quite a number of scientists who are as dogmatic nowadays as the bishops used to be in the old days, and I think a lot of scientists are overstepping the bounds. They're claiming a lot more for science than it can do. In particular, there are scientists who are making metaphysical claims on the basis of science which is philosophically simply incorrect, and they haven't learnt what Kant and Hume were saying.
Well, I'll have to agree with you there. I always liked Socrates' idea that the true philosopher is the one who knows how little he knows. That's the Socrates in some of the dialogues. The Socrates in the other dialogue sometimes seems like just another pompous philosopher that thinks he knows everything.
Yeah.
But let's go back to this question about, I'm inclined to agree with the objectivity of ethics. There's something that's transcultural, that's right and wrong, torturing children, so forth and so on. But does objectivity in ethics really require that there be some kind of supernatural basis? Can it just be based in the human nature, a common human nature across all cultures?
And that science could tell us what that human nature is that gives rise to ethics.
Yeah. Okay, well, what you've got to do there, obviously what you're then starting on is the evolutionary biology explanation. You say, look, ethics arose because cavemen had certain interactions and it got built into their genes. You survived if you did it this way rather than that way. Well, not just cavemen, all of our ancestors before that. And so you can try to explain ethics on this evolutionary biology route.
Yeah, right.
Now, the problem with that is it doesn't explain it. Firstly, you can, once you've applied that to ethics, why don't you apply it to physics? Why don't you apply it to chemistry? They have also arisen in an evolutionary biology way, and insofar as the one arose from evolutionary biology, so did the other.
Well, that gives us a lot to think about. I like that idea of explaining physics that way, but maybe Ken has something else to say.
Yeah, I do, but we need to take a short break here, and after the break, we'll have our 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes tell us about an attempt to explain, you know, all sorts of things about human beings in reductionistic terms by B.F. Skinner. Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
John Lennon with a partial list of things he didn't believe in. That's the song God from his 1970 album, John Lennon. I'm not John Lennon, I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Today we're asking the question, has science driven religion out of the explanatory domain? Today we're going to hear a little bit from Ian Scholes, right, John?
Yes, Ian. We've been talking to George Ellis, who's a non-reductionist, and we're going to hear from Ian about one of the 20th century's great reductionists, B.F. Skinner, a reductionist if there ever was one. Our 60-second philosopher, ready, go.
Ian Scholes, B.F. Skinner was one of the most influential American psychologists of the 20th century. Born Burris Frederick Skinner in 1904 in Pennsylvania, he grew up wanting to be a writer, majoring in English in college and living for a while in Greenwich Village. He gave that up and went back to school, getting his doctorate in psychology from Harvard in 1931. In the 30s, he published The Behavior of Organisms. He also invented the Skinner Box, a box with a test animal, a lever, and a food dispenser under an experimenter's control. From there, Skinner built his vision. Skinner did not focus his psychology on inner states, but strictly on behavior. He believed that human behavior stems from either natural selection or what he called operant conditioning. Behavior is followed by a consequence, and the nature of the consequence modifies the organism's tendency to repeat the behavior in the future. The rat in the Skinner box presses the lever and gets a pellet. Thus, the rat will be inclined to push the lever some more. Then he instituted schedules of reinforcement. Sometimes the rat would get a pellet from the push and sometimes not. Skinner claimed that this is why people gamble. Even if you lose 100 times, it's worth it for the pellet of the one pot you rake in. B.F. Skinner passed away in 1990. Beyond the Skinner box and his brand of behaviorism, which shaped American psychology for 40 years, Skinner is best known for Walden 2, his novel about a utopian commune run by operant conditioning. When this book was criticized for taking away individualism, Skinner countered with Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which said that freedom and dignity are just superstitions. We do bad when bad is rewarded, and good when good is rewarded. The world's operant conditioning is chaotic, but we can extinguish evil using the appropriate behavioral psychology. His chipper, can-do, let's-roll-up-our-sleeves-and-fix-it approach to morality found a huge positive response in America. Educators used behavior modification in classrooms. Corporate middle managers employed it for employees, and hippies started communes based on the egalitarian principles of Walden II. Oh, he had critics. Take Walden, too. Its code asks that communards must all do menial hard work, avoid unnecessary possessions, never express gratitude, never compare anybody to anybody else, never gossip, not spend time exclusively with one's own children, not talk to outsiders about Walden II affairs, avoid competition, avoid hero worship, and find history irrelevant. Is this behaviorism or totalitarianism? I suppose it depends on who's dispensing the pellets. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, dissecting the life of B.F. Skinner. I'm John Perry, and I've got to run get a pellet, so I'll let Ken Taylor say a few things.
I'm Ken Taylor, and John cracks me up every week here. Our guest is George Ellis of the University of Cape Town, South Africa, winner of this year's Templeton Prize for Progress Toward Research or Discoveries about Spiritual Realities. Usually we take a lot more phone calls than we have this time. Because of the way the conversation's gone, we haven't been able to. And if you want to continue this discussion with us, we apologize for that. Please go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org. Sign up for our forum, and we'll have some exchange with you. I do think we have an email question, though, right, John?
Yeah. Professor Ellis, there's so much in your work I'd like to talk to you about, the whole idea of top-down causation and aesthetics and ethics. But one, we've got an email that I think gets at something very interesting that we'd like to hear your response to. It's from Marcia, and she says, "You seem to be discussing organized religion and not looking at individual faith. No fair to discuss organized religion and not discuss politics." Well, those are two good points. Now, I don't know if you think of yourself as part of organized religion. Insofar as I'm religious, I'm a Protestant. It's kind of a disorganized religion. But we haven't said much about faith. It sounds like even as you go beyond science, you're still looking for reasons for religious belief. And are you leaving out faith, a typical part, at least, of Christian religion?
No, not at all. I'm actually having quite a lot of fun at the moment writing about the tension between rationality on the one hand and faith and hope on the other. And I think this is absolutely crucial. In a sense, the scientific hope is you can get by on rationality alone. You never need faith or hope, and that's just an illusion. We never, ever have enough data in the ordinary world, let alone in the metaphysical or religious dimensions. And so faith and hope are essential for our lives. But then the question is that not all faiths are equal, not all hopes are equal. And so the really interesting point of the discussion, in a sense, is what is a reasonable hope? What is a justifiable faith? And there's this kind of a contradiction there. Because it's a faith or a hope, you know it's not provable, but yet they're not all equal to each other. And so that's a really interesting discussion. So now I believe strongly in faith and hope. And just in terms of organized religion, I must just add I belong to the Quakers, which is one of the religious groups which does not try to prescribe to you how to think. It does not prescribe a creed or so, and it is very much in consonance with present-day science.
But now, Quakers don't sing during their meetings, do they?
That's right. That's one of the things which I miss.
I could not be a Quaker for that reason.
I want to press you a little bit about this faith, reasonable faith. You said it was a puzzling, and I am puzzled, because I would think that faith begins where reason runs out. And the arguments that you were giving about, you know, the need to posit somebody who does the fine-tuning, those were appeals to reason, I take it. And if those arguments don't carry the day, then I don't see what's the point of faith in leaping over those arguments. And if they do carry the day, I don't see what the point of faith is, because you don't need it.
Well, those arguments can't close the ring, and that's what we were told by Hume Kant. So they indicate a direction, but they simply can't give you the conclusion, and faith is needed for that conclusion. But I've really been understanding this business of not all faiths are equal, because I've just been reading the book on the last days of Berlin, and Hitler had a faith that his armies, which were in flight and totally disorganized, would somehow turn around and smite the Allies, and his faith was not a reasonable faith. And there is really a difference between a reasonable faith and an unreasonable faith.
So let me see if I've got it right. Your point of view, we might say, which is your point of view? First, that any reasonable person, if they look at the total evidence, will acknowledge spiritual realities? Or second, a reasonable person can acknowledge spiritual realities and be in complete line with and not opposed to all the evidence we have, but he can also not.
Yeah, I take the second one. I like to talk about intimations of transcendence. There are many phenomena which seem to go beyond what is necessary. And it's a value judgment. It's a value call. Just a little example. I was sitting here one day looking down on the ocean in Camps Bay out here, which is a beautiful place, and I saw 12 dolphins surfing in the surf. And a couple of them were doing somersaults. They were flipping for the joy of it. And the whole thing just had that quality of being more than is necessary.
Well, Professor Ellis, you're not only a relativistic cosmologist, you're also a metaphysician, and for me, that's praise, not criticism.
Yeah, well, me too, the metaphysician part. I do have to say I probably in fundamental disagree with you at some level, because on the one hand, I think the universe just, what causes me amazement is that this universe is this self-sustaining, self-creating thing, and that's just wonderful in itself. So I don't really know that I need to posit something beyond, but that's just me.
Yeah.
But it's been a pleasure. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, Professor Ellis.
Thanks a lot, Professor Ellis. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
So, John, what wisdom have you gained? We've been talking to a very wise man, obviously.
Yeah, he sounds like he sounds like a Quaker and a scientist, and that's a nice combination. With a little South African accent thrown in, perhaps. I don't know, Ken. My whole life I've waffled between being religious in various ways, you know, kind of Christian when I was a kid, and then sort of Protestant when I was in college, you know, Paul Tillich, and then with a little Martin Buber thrown in, and then atheist, and then agnostic, and so forth.
All over
the
map.
All over the map. The one thing I have faith in is philosophy, and I think it is faith. Who knows if thinking things through really helps, but I have faith that it does. I am constantly impressed with how many of these ideas you can find in a book I want to call to the attention of all our listeners, Hume's Dialogues on Natural Religion.
Yeah.
It's clear that Professor Ellis admires it. I admire it, and Ken, you're going to tell us you admire it. Right?
Well, I do admire. Hume's one of the great philosophers, but one of the things I really don't know about the need to explain the universe as a whole, because the explanations we give ultimately run out, you know, one way or the other. So just let the universe be.
Well, agree with you there, but I think Professor Ellis's point is maybe we don't need to explain it, but if you want to explain it, this isn't an irrational approach.
No, it's not irrational. Just unnecessary.
Unnecessary. Well, thanks to our listeners, and it's been fun discussing religion.
I hear drumming in the background.
That's not drumming, that's conundrumming.
What's a conundrum?
A conundrum is a puzzle, a bothers someone, either philosophical or having to do with their life, and they phone in, they tell us about it, and we give them some advice that's of no help whatsoever.
Yeah, we've got a caller on the line now who wants to tell us something. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave.
Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Where are you calling from, Dave?
I'm calling from Boston.
Boston. Oh, I've heard of that.
A little suburb of New York City.
New York City.
They play in the... No, they don't play in the World Series. They play,
you're being mean.
What do you do out there?
Wait till next year.
I attend bar.
Oh, that's good. Oh, you probably got some good conundrums.
Well, my problem involves my living situation. I live with in a house with five people, and one of my roommates sort of borrowed some money from me without telling me about it.
Sort of borrowed without telling you.
Yeah,
that sounds like stealing.
I wouldn't exactly call it stealing because he returned the money and also let me know about it before I even had the chance to find out. He was very apologetic and also honest about it in the end.
We're talking about $5?
A little bit more than that, more in the line of a little bit over $100.
Yeah, that's so serious money where I come from.
Offhand, I would say if he takes your money, it's stealing. You know, it's ameliorated by two facts. First, that he told you that he'd taken the money, and second, that he, well, three facts. Second, he did so with the intention of giving it back, and thirdly, he actually did give it back.
Okay, so let's suppose we grant John's point that it's stealing, although it's ameliorated by these factors he's talked about. Now, I take it that's just the first step. He stole something?
Yeah, it is the first step in a way. I guess my problem is whether or not the other housemates need to know about it. I in a way, feel like they should because a certain level of trust was broken within the house, yet I fear that their response will be more harsh than I think would be just.
How harsh is your own response?
My roommate was he was very apologetic as soon as it happened, and I spoke with him about it, let him know that it was that I felt it was a very, very serious matter, and that if I even sniffed anything like that happening again, that we might have to ask him to leave the house and certainly let the other roommates know about it.
Well, suppose you don't tell them and somebody's missing a couple $100.
Exactly. That's
How are you going to feel about that? Are you going to feel, well, it's up to me to pay him back?
I don't know if I'd feel like it was up to me to pay them back, but I'd certainly feel...
You'd feel responsible.
I'd feel guilty in a way.
I mean, my analysis, my hard-hearted analysis is from a prudential point of view, you ought to cover your own backside, and that would mean... I would say I'm planning to tell him on this date. If you want to tell him before then, I won't have to. From a moral point of view, I don't think you have any obligation to him not to tell him, and it seems like you might well have an obligation to your roommates to tell him. That might depend on details of the situation.
I'm not sure I share your hard-heartedness, John. It depends on how close of friends you guys are.
Right.
I mean, if you're close friends, then I think the morality of the situation is governed by the norms of friendship. I mean, he violated those norms. I think you can hold him to that, but I'm not sure about broadcasting it to the rest of these people you're also friends with them. So I don't know. I think it's a complicated thing. I wouldn't be as hard-hearted as John, though.
Probably not. What would you do if it was $10,000?
Oh, well, that's a different matter there.
It is a different matter. Okay, $500.
You're trying to get him in a sorority's paradise.
Yeah, what if it was 3 grains of sand? Then what would you do?
Right? Yeah, well, I'm sure we haven't solved your conundrum.
We don't even agree amongst ourselves.
I hope we've helped you at least think about it somewhat.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen.
If you have a dilemma that's infected your mind that bedevils your imagination, we'd like to help.
Oh, we'd like to help. We probably won't be able to. We won't take your money, and we'll be happy to share our 2 cents. Send an email describing your conundrum to conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Don't forget to let us know where we can reach you so that you can join us on the program. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the conundrums button. So that's the easiest way.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley. And also to Philip Clayton.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and members of KALW, Information Radio, San Francisco's oldest FM station, 91.7, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders or mine or John's or anybody's.
Continue the conversation on our website, www.philosophytalk.org.
And I'm
John Perry.
Oh, and I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.